Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Deep Dive. I'm Sam McGee, your guide, and today we are plunging headfirst into the Register RSS Feed's evening edition for Friday, September 5th, 2025.
And I'm Taylor Ladis, the expert, here to help connect the dots and explore what these developments truly mean for us, our businesses, and, well, our daily lives. This deep dive is packed with fascinating articles. We're covering everything from the subtle biases of AI in hiring, all the way to the high-stakes world of space exploration and critical infrastructure. Our mission, as always, is to sift through the noise. We want to extract the most important nuggets of knowledge and really lay out the core implications for you, our listener.
That's exactly right. Today's deep dive promises a compelling blend. We've got groundbreaking innovations, some really pressing security concerns, significant shifts in tech policy, and yeah, a few head-scratching business decisions that they speak volumes about where the industry is heading. So let's unpack this and get you well informed. Okay, we're kicking things off today with something incredibly relevant to, well, probably many of you listening, the AI revolution and how it's fundamentally impacting the job market. There are some truly eye-opening and frankly a bit unsettling findings regarding AI's algorithmic bias in hiring.
Mm-hmm.
Researchers have found that the very AI models designed to, streamline hiring processes actually tend to favor applications generated by other AI models over humans.
Yeah, that's the really wild part.
This phenomenon, which they call AI self-preferencing, is quite pronounced. We're talking larger models like GPT-4o, GPT-4 Turbo, LaMe 3.370b. They're showing this bias somewhere between 68% and a frankly staggering 88%. So it immediately raises this big question, right? If you're not using the right AI to craft your resume, are you already at a disadvantage in what we all hope is a fair hiring process?
Well, exactly. And what these findings really underscore isn't necessarily like explicit discrimination in a legal sense. It's not someone programming it to be biased. It's more of an inherent subtle self-preference within these large language models.
Yeah.
But it has these profound implications for equitable opportunity.
Okay.
The research clearly shows the bias is strongest when an AI prefers its own output over human written content.
Yeah.
And interestingly, it's even more biased towards its own stuff than towards content from a different AI model.
Wow. Okay. So if you happen to use the same AI.
Right. If you use the same LLM as the company evaluating your application, you could be shortlisted anywhere from 23% to 60% more often.
Yeah.
That's a significant edge.
Yeah.
And it seemed particularly pronounced in business-related fields. Think sales, accounting.
Why there specifically?
Well, the thinking is that the language, the structure, maybe the keyword usage in those applications is often more standardized, So it's easier for AI to replicate it well and consequently easier for it to, well, prefer it. The core implication here is that we've got to critically examine how these systems are designed and deployed. We need to recognize their internal mechanics can subtly, yet powerfully, shape who gets noticed and ultimately who gets hired. This isn't just about efficiency anymore. It really strikes at the heart of fairness and access in the modern workforce.
That's a crucial point, and it's not just some academic curiosity either, is it?
Not at all.
Janie Jiang, she's one of the co-authors of the paper AI Self-Preferencing and Algorithmic Hiring. She emphasizes that, yeah, while it isn't discrimination in that legal framework, it absolutely raises significant fairness questions. It subtly influences who gets through those initial hiring stages.
Mm-hmm. And the scale is what's worrying.
Exactly. This isn't a niche problem affecting just a few early adopters. A survey from last October indicated that a substantial 7 out of 10 companies expect to be using AI in their hiring by 2025. And that's even with many of them acknowledging that these systems can carry biases. So it just highlights the immediate widespread relevance. The potential impact on a global scale is huge.
Right. So given these, pretty pervasive issues, the researchers did put forth a couple of practical solutions.
Yeah.
Things to try and mitigate this AI self-preferencing.
Okay. What are they suggesting?
Well, one main approach involves explicitly instructing the AI models. They do this through what are called system prompts. Basically telling the AI to disregard the origin of the resume, doesn't matter if it's human or AI written, and just focus purely on the content's merit.
And does that work?
Apparently, yeah. Mm-hmm. For instance, when they gave GPT-4o those clear instructions, its self-preference dropped significantly. It went from over 90% down to below 50%, which is considered, basically neutral or unbiased.
Okay, that sounds promising. What's the other idea?
The second strategy suggests involving multiple different AI models in the evaluation process.
Ah, okay. Like getting a second opinion, but from AIs.
Sort of, yeah. The theory is that by having several AIs independently assess applications, the inherent self-preference of any single model gets diluted. You end up with a more balanced, potentially fairer assessment.
Right.
However, and this is important, Jiang notes there's a critical trade-off here that really demands our attention.
Okay.
If you reduce an AI's ability to detect whether content was AI or human-written, which you might want for hiring fairness, well, ironically, that could hinder its effectiveness in other crucial areas.
Like what?
Think about education or journalism. In those fields, being able to accurately identify AI-generated content is vital, right? For transparency, academic integrity, factual accuracy.
Yeah, absolutely. You don't want AI essays slipping through undetected.
Exactly. So the challenge lies in striking this incredibly complex and probably context-dependent balance. Fairness in one area versus essential detection capabilities in another. It's tricky.
Okay, let's shift gears a bit. Moving from those subtle biases in hiring to the much more high-stakes world of cybersecurity, here we see AI playing this truly dual role. It's acting as both a potent weapon for attackers and an increasingly sophisticated shield for defenders.
Yeah, this is where the digital arms race really heats up.
Definitely. On the offensive side, cybercriminals are rapidly adopting powerful tools. There's one called HexStrike AI. It's an open-source red-teaming framework.
Mm-hmm.
Amit Wagman from Checkpoint, he's observed attackers leveraging this HexStrike AI to exploit critical vulnerabilities, like those in Citrix NetScaler bugs, within mere hours of them being publicly disclosed.
Wow, incredibly fast.
It shrinks that window for defenders to patch systems and put protections almost to nothing.
And this rapid adoption, this exploitation, is genuinely alarming. Because HexStrike AI, it really represents a significant leap in offensive capabilities. It integrates smoothly with over 150 security tools, a dozen AI agents, allowing it to automate these complex tasks, reconnaissance, exploit development, discovering entire attack chains.
So it makes sophisticated attacks easier.
Way easier. Essentially, it collapses the barrier to entry for these highly complex exploits. It lets less skilled adversaries operate with the speed and scale that defenders have, you know, historically struggled to keep up with.
Right.
And beyond just exploiting existing bugs, we're also seeing entirely new forms of AI-powered crime emerge. ESET, for instance, they uncovered something called PromptLock. It's a proof-of-concept AI-powered ransomware. And Anthropic reported its Claude Code AI was actually leveraged in a data extortion operation targeting 17 organizations. Ransom demands from $75,000 up to $500,000.
Jeez.
And the experts, people like Nick Biasini at Cisco Talos, Ari Redbord at TRM Labs, they're now predicting that agentic AI that can make decisions on its own will soon orchestrate and scale criminal activities. It could potentially replace human ransomware affiliates for tasks like picking targets, maybe even handling negotiations. There's already a group, global group, using an AI chatbot for ransom talk.
That's chilling, actually.
It is. And the crucial implication here is that as these AI tools become more accessible to both sides, attackers and defenders, we're seeing an acceleration in vulnerability discovery and exploit development. This really demands critical thinking in how we allocate resources, because the cost efficiencies of AI, they're clearly benefiting both sides of this fight.
But it's certainly not all doom and gloom on the cyber defense front, right? AI is also emerging as this incredibly powerful shield. It's offering innovative ways to protect our digital stuff.
Absolutely. There's some really promising work happening there.
Like researchers from Nanjing University and the University of Sydney, they've developed something called A2. It's an AI agent system designed to emulate human bug hunters.
Right. Basically an AI security researcher.
Exactly. Its purpose is to discover and validate vulnerabilities in Android apps. And this system, it's already shown superior performance. It achieves 78.3% coverage on the GARA benchmark. That significantly outperforms traditional static analyzers like APK Hunt, which only manage 30%.
Yeah, that's a big jump.
It really highlights AI's potential to enhance our defensive capabilities.
A2's capabilities are, they're genuinely remarkable. And they offer this promising vision for the future of defensive cybersecurity. I mean, the system found an impressive 104 true positive zero-day vulnerabilities. And 169 production APKs. These are, you know, widely used Android app packages.
0 days.
Yeah.
So flaws nobody knew about before.
Exactly. And even more remarkably, 57 of those vulnerabilities were self-validated. It used automatically generated proof-of-concept exploits.
So it didn't just find the bug, it proved it could be exploited.
Precisely. And the ingenuity of A2 lies in its very human-like approach. It uses commercial AI models, OpenAI O3, Gemini Pro Flash, GPT-SS, and deploys them in these distinct roles, planner, executor, validator. It meticulously mirrors the complex workflow of human security experts. They gave a detailed example in their research, showed how A2 successfully identified and exploited a hard-coded AES key to forge password reset tokens. Just shows its ability to not only detect flaws, but confirm their exploitability with real precision.
And is it practical? Cost-effective?
That's the other potential game changer. From a practical standpoint, the cost effectiveness is huge. The cost per vulnerability found and validated by A2 is significantly lower than potential bug bounty awards. You know, what companies typically pay for similar discoveries. This highlights a really promising AI arbitrage opportunity for defenders.
AI arbitrage, interesting phrase.
Yeah, it suggests AI could dramatically lower the cost of proactive security. It lets organizations find and fix bugs much more efficiently and at scale than ever before. Could potentially turn the tide in this cyber arms race.
Okay. Beyond security, another crucial area where AI is making significant inroads, sometimes complicated ones, is in productivity and data privacy. Let's first look at how it's affecting our day-to-day work. There was a 3-month trial by the UK Department for Business and Trade. They looked at Microsoft's M365 Copilot, and the results. Decidedly mixed. Specifically, they showed no discernible gain in productivity.
That's not quite the sales pitch, is it?
Not really. Well, okay, a respectable 72% of users said they were satisfied. The actual daily usage was pretty low, averaged just 1.14 actions per user per day. So it suggests that while AI might speed up some tasks, it's definitely not a magic bullet for overall productivity.
Right.
And it clearly functions more as a tool that needs human oversight rather than a direct replacement for people.
Yeah, the trial's findings paint a really nuanced picture of Copilot's actual real-world utility. So yeah, it was effective speeding up tasks like summarizing meetings, drafting emails, the usual suspects. But paradoxically, it slowed down or even worsened the quality of more complex stuff, like Excel data analysis, PowerPoint slide creation, often needing corrective human intervention.
So you end up spending time fixing the AI's work.
Pretty much. And compounding these issues, a significant 22% of participants reported identifying hallucinations.
Ah, yes, the AI making things up.
Exactly. Yeah. Instances where the AI generated incorrect or just fabricated information.
Yeah.
So when you weigh these mixed results against the high cost, which is what, £4.90 to £18 per user per month?
Somewhere in that range, yeah.
And you consider MIT's broader finding that something like $35 to $40 billion has already been sunk into Gen AI by companies with little clear ROI. It raises serious questions about the immediate, tangible value proposition of these tools right now.
So the hype might be ahead of the reality.
It seems that way. The core implication is that effectively integrating and using AI is far more intricate, more challenging than just deploying the tech and expecting instant gains. It takes work.
Right. And on the other side of this AI coin, we have this critical issue of data privacy and this emerging concept of AI unlearning.
Yes. Making the AI forget.
Exactly. AI models are facing increasing legal and ethical scrutiny, right? Because they're trained on these vast amounts of scraped data, data that might include copyrighted material or information that violates privacy regulations like GDPR or CCPA's right to erasure.
And the challenge is immense because fully retraining these massive models to exclude the problematic data, it's astronomically expensive.
How expensive are we talking?
Billions of dollars. Tens of millions of GPU hours. It just renders it an impractical solution for most organizations.
Okay, so retraining is basically off the table for most.
Pretty much. And the underlying tension here is profound, isn't it? You have this boundless appetite for data that fuels powerful AI development, but it often clashes directly with fundamental individual rights, privacy, intellectual property.
So how do we square that circle?
Well, researchers at UC Riverside have made some significant progress. They've developed this innovative source-free unlearning method.
Source-free, meaning they don't need the original data.
Exactly. That's the key. It uses a surrogate data set, a single-step Newton update, and carefully calibrated random noise to statistically guarantee the removal of undesired information from a model without needing access to that original training data. It offers a potential path forward for compliance, for privacy.
Okay, that sounds technically impressive, but are there limitations?
Oh, definitely. It's important to note the current limitations. This method is primarily focused on simpler machine learning models so far, not the full-blown, immensely complex large language models we talk about too often.
So still early days for LLMs.
Right. It indicates that while the concept is sound, it's promising. Much more research and development are needed. especially in designing effective surrogate datasets, before it can fully address the privacy challenges posed by today's most powerful AI systems. The fundamental question this raises is, can we truly have powerful, universally beneficial AI without inevitably compromising these core human values? Or will it always require this delicate, continuous balancing act?
All right, let's shift our gaze now, way up, far beyond our terrestrial concerns, to the critical infrastructure that is space itself. The new space race is definitely intensifying. It's marked by ambitious projects, some significant delays, and increasingly complex dependencies.
Mm-hmm. Lots happening up there.
Take Amazon's Project Kuiper, for instance. It's already taking flight, and with some truly impressive speed demonstrations. They recently showcased download speeds peaking at 1.28 gigabits per second from their, you know, still nascent internet satellite service. The average was 11,189 megabits per second in stage tests.
That's genuinely fast,
yeah.
Especially from space.
Right. That's the kind of speed that could transform connectivity. They've even secured a partnership with JetBlue. JetBlue plans to offer free Kuiper internet access across its fleet starting in 2027.
Okay, so the speeds are impressive. A significant technical achievement, no doubt. Highlights the rapid advancements in satellite internet. However,
yeah.
It's important context here that Amazon is a relatively late entrant to this orbital ISP market.
Right. Starlink has a big head start.
It's a huge head start.
Yep.
Amazon currently has just over 100 satellites in orbit. That's pretty modest compared to Starlink's, 8,000 plus operational satellites now?
Wow. Okay. Big difference.
Yeah. Kuiper aims to launch commercial services by mid-2026, starting in Australia. But the massive scaling challenge, deploying thousands more satellites, basically mini routers, into orbit. That remains a formidable hurdle.
How are they planning to get them all up there?
Well, they've had to secure launch contracts with multiple providers. United Launch Alliance for their Atlas V, SpaceX for Falcon 9, Ariane Space for Ariane 6. Interestingly, Jeff Bezos' own Blue Origin, their new Glenn rocket, which you'd think would play a major role. Its progress has been described as glacial.
Huh. So even having your own rocket company doesn't guarantee smooth sailing.
Apparently not.
What?
It really highlights the practical complexities, the dependencies inherent in scaling such an ambitious project, even for a company with Amazon's immense resources, the core implication here. While commercial innovation drives exciting progress, the realities of manufacturing, launching, deploying infrastructure at orbital scale, they present significant multifaceted challenges, even for the tech giants.
Okay. While some players are racing to launch these satellite constellations, others are grappling with significant delays. Specifically, in returning humans to the moon.
Ah, yes, the Artemis program.
Former NASA Administrator Jim Bridenstine, he's voiced strong concerns. He stated it's highly unlikely the U.S. will return humans to the lunar surface before China.
That's a pretty bold and worrying statement from a former administrator.
It is, and he directly attributes this potential setback to NASA's chosen architecture for Artemis, specifically pointing fingers at SpaceX's Starship Human Landing System, the HLS.
Right, and Bridenstine outlined several critical issues with the Starship HLS that, collectively cast doubt on its readiness and its viability for the aggressive timeline NASA has set.
What are the main sticking points?
Well, a primary concern is the sheer unknown number of launches needed for its in-space refueling operations.
Refueling in space? That sounds complex.
It's incredibly complex, and it's a truly critical process that, as yet, has never been fully tested in orbit. Not on this scale.
Okay. What else?
Furthermore, the HLS variant itself. It hasn't received human rating certification yet. That means it hasn't been certified for human spaceflight operations. And that rigorous process, it hasn't even properly begun.
So, still a long way to go on safety certification.
Seems so. He also raised important questions about how long Starship can safely loiter in lunar orbit while waiting for the Orion spacecraft, and whether a proposed 7-day surface mission designed without a direct return capability to Orion represents an acceptable level of risk for the astronauts.
Right, that sounds risky.
Bridenstine went so far as to call the decision to select a single partner SpaceX back in 2021. He called it the biggest decision in NASA's recent history. And he noted it was controversially made when there wasn't a confirmed NASA administrator in place.
The politics behind the scenes.
Always. The core implication here is that pushing the boundaries of space exploration, especially when there's geopolitical pressure involved, it needs this careful balance. Innovation, risk assessment, and crucially proven integrated systems. The moon mission really highlights the critical importance of a robust, fully vetted architecture. Any misstep could have severe consequences
mm-hmm.
for national prestige and, more importantly, for astronaut safety.
Right. Okay, amidst these ambitious projects and their setbacks, SpaceX has notched a crucial success much closer to home. They successfully reboosted the International Space Station. Their Dragon CRS-33 cargo spacecraft recently raised the ISS's perigee, its lowest point in orbit, by about 1 mile.
Yeah, that successful maneuver, while it might seem minor on the surface, it actually carries significant strategic importance.
That's awesome.
Well, it further diminishes the ISS's reliance on Russia's Progress spacecraft for maintaining its altitude. Russia's space program has, you know, faced increasing reliability concerns in recent years. Even their CEO, Igor Maltev, made candid comments about its decrepit state. So SpaceX demonstrating this capability to independently maintain the ISS's altitude, it represents a critical shift, reduces geopolitical dependencies for this vital piece of international infrastructure.
And potentially longer-term implications, too.
Absolutely. This reboost capability also subtly hints at SpaceX's future role in the eventual controlled deorbiting of the ISS, which is a highly complex, absolutely crucial task required at the end of its operational life.
Right, got to bring it down safely somehow.
Exactly. The broader implication here is this evolving landscape of space power. As commercial entities demonstrate increasing capabilities, they're profoundly reshaping national strategic objectives. They're reducing dependencies on traditional space powers. This ongoing shift raises important questions about international cooperation, competition, and the future governance of space as both, you know, a domain of exploration and critical infrastructure.
Okay. Moving from the vastness of space down to the foundational power of our digital world, let's talk data centers, cloud sovereignty, and evolving business strategies. President Trump recently hosted this high-profile dinner. Silicon Valley leaders were there. Bill Gates, Tim Cook, Sam Altman, Sundar Pichai, Arvind Krishna, Mark Zuckerberg, the big names.
Quite the guest list.
Indeed. And during this gathering, he made a pledge for federal action to remove existing obstacles in connecting new data centers to the national electricity grid.
The power problem. This pledge addresses a rapidly escalating crisis, doesn't it?
Seems so.
The unprecedented AI boom, coupled with this perceived AI arms race with China, is driving absolutely massive investment in new data centers. I mean, just think about Amazon's cloud capital expenditure. It now exceeds $100 billion per year. Meta's planning multi-gigawatt campuses just for AI.
That's a staggering amount of power demand.
It is. And this surging demand is creating a significant energy bottleneck. Deloitte Insights warns that U.S. data center energy needs could increase an astonishing 30-fold in just a decade. And some new grid connections are already facing waits as long as 7 years.
7 years, wow.
Yeah. Without urgent, coordinated action, American consumers could see a projected 70% hike in electricity bills by 2030.
So what's the proposed solution?
Well, Trump's administration has responded with an executive order designed to speed up permitting for data center infrastructure. Furthermore, it explicitly favors nuclear power as a solution. We're already seeing examples like Hyundai building modular reactors in Texas, specifically for a data center project.
Interesting. Nuclear for data centers.
Yeah. And Hitachi Energy also announced a $1 billion investment in U.S. grid infrastructure. So collectively, it highlights this concerted national effort to address this growing critical bottleneck. The key implication: the future of the digital economy, so heavily reliant on AI now, is fundamentally intertwined with our energy infrastructure. It's forcing this rapid, large-scale reevaluation of national power generation and distribution strategies.
Okay. In other significant business news, Broadcom, they recently posted record Q3 2025 revenues, largely propelled by their big VMware acquisition.
Right. That acquisition is paying off. Financially, at least.
Seems so. However, their CEO, Hock Tan, made a rather interesting admission. He said that while 90% of Broadcom's top 10,000 customers have indeed subscribed to VMware Cloud Foundation, or VCF, that's their primary bundled software offering, many of these customers haven't fully deployed it.
The shelfware phenomenon. Buying software, but not actually using it much.
Exactly. That's the term they used.
Yeah, that shelfware admission is quite telling. Speaks volumes about the complexities of enterprise software sales and, crucially, customer adoption strategies. So Broadcom's core strategy for the next couple of years is to actively work on convincing these existing customers to fully implement and use VCF.
Get it off the shelf and into production.
Precisely. And once that's achieved, the plan is to then upsell them advanced services layered on top. Think enhanced security, disaster recovery, AI capabilities. And concurrently, they aim to expand VCF sales into mid-sized companies as well.
Makes sense. Grow the base, then deepen the engagement.
Right. And in parallel to this software strategy, Broadcom's semiconductor revenue saw a really robust 26% year-on-year increase, reached $9.2 billion. A significant chunk of that, $5.2 billion, came from AI-related chips, or XPUs as they call them. That sector experienced remarkable 63% growth.
So the AI chip boom is definitely benefiting them too.
Hugely. Broadcom even secured a fourth large XPU customer in Q3. That hints at increasing competition with established giants like NVIDIA and AMD in this burgeoning AI accelerator market. The key implication is that these major tech players are navigating a really complex landscape. They're trying to maximize returns from strategic acquisitions like VMware, while also aggressively pursuing new high-growth opportunities in the booming AI hardware sector. Requires a delicate balance, existing customer relationships versus cutting-edge innovation.
Okay, turning our attention now to Europe. SAP is making a significant, very strategic move. They're announcing an investment of a massive €2 over 10 years. The goal, to expand its sovereign cloud infrastructure across the continent.
20 billion euros, that's a serious commitment.
It is, and they are deliberately positioning themselves as a secure, compliant alternative to the major U.S. cloud giants. Directly addressing those growing concerns about GDPR Europe's robust data protection regulation and the potential for U.S. government access to European data.
Yeah, especially after incidents like Meta's huge $1.2 billion fine in Ireland, that really focused minds on data sovereignty.
Exactly.
So SAP's substantial investment is a direct, calculated response to this increasing demand for stringent data sovereignty. Heightened by concerns over cross-border data transfers, legal frameworks like the U.S. Cloud Act.
What are they actually offering?
They're offering three distinct sovereign cloud options to meet different needs. First, SAP Cloud Infrastructure guarantees all data storage within the EU. Simple enough. Second, Sovereign Cloud Onsite gives customers flexibility to use their own data centers or specific selected ones. And third, Delos Cloud in Germany, catering specifically to country-specific regulatory requirements there.
So trying to cover all the bases for sovereignty concerns.
Pretty much. And yeah. SAP is keenly emphasizing what they call full-stack sovereignty, meaning they're building privacy and control into every layer of their offerings. Software, AI, applied innovation. They're not trying to compete directly with the hyperscalers like AWS or Azure on sheer global infrastructure scale. It's more about compliance and trust.
Right, a different value proposition.
Exactly. This investment will leverage and expand their existing European data center footprint and strategic partnerships. The broader implication here, we're seeing this global pivot towards localized control over data and digital infrastructure, driven by this powerful mix of political agendas, competitive advantage, and escalating regulatory pressures. It raises a fundamental question about the long-term impact on the inherently globalized nature of tech services and the potential for increased digital fragmentation along national or regional lines.
Okay, one more from the cloud sector. IBM Cloud, they're implementing a significant shift in their customer support model. Starting in January 2026, their free basic support tier. It's transitioning entirely to an AI-driven self-service model.
Ah, so no more free human help for basic users.
Essentially, yes. Customers on that tier will lose the ability to open or escalate technical support cases through traditional portals or APIs. They'll have to rely on AI and docs.
Okay. While IBM frames this as aligning with industry standards and aiming to improve your support experience, let's be real. The decision likely reflects their position in a highly competitive cloud market. IBM Cloud holds a relatively small market share, right? Hovering around 2-4%.
Yeah, way behind AWS, Azure, Google Cloud.
Exactly. So this move suggests either a strategic cost-cutting measure or maybe a deliberate decision to focus their human support resources on higher-tier paid customers.
Where are they directing the basic users then?
They're suggesting using their WatsonX-powered AI assistant and an expanded library of support documentation. They also plan to launch a report and issue tool for faster automated routing. But for customers needing direct technical support, faster response times, or the ability to control severity levels, the explicit recommendation is upgrade to a paid plan.
And those start at?
Around $200 per month.
Okay. Yeah. Not insignificant.
No. And this strategy isn't entirely unique. We saw China's Tencent stop working with basic cloud service customers because those accounts just weren't profitable. The core implication is that the increasing complexity and cost of cloud services, combined with the rising capabilities of AI, it's pushing providers to redefine customer support. This will likely create new divisions in service quality. Premium human support becomes a paid differentiated offering, while basic users rely primarily on AI and self-service.
All right, let's turn our attention now to the dynamic world of software ecosystems that power our devices. We'll start with Android's ever-present security landscape. Sukumar has brought what's being described as a mega patch bomb from Android. We're talking a massive 120 flaw fixes the largest update this year.
120 flaws, that's a lot.
It is, and critically within this update, two high-severity vulnerabilities, CVE-2025-38352 in the Linux kernel, CVE-2025-48543 in the Android runtime, are already confirmed to be under active exploitation in the wild.
Oof, actively exploited 0 days, that's never good news.
No. And these are particularly concerning. They allow for local privilege escalation without any user interaction, meaning attackers can gain deeper control over a device without you even clicking anything. It often feels like Android users are just in this constant state of playing catch-up with security, doesn't it? Especially if you're not on a Google Pixel device.
Yeah, the fragmentation issue really bites here.
Two actively exploited 0 days are a significant cause for concern. But as we touched on earlier, it's important to remember AI is stepping up to help find these bugs faster, too.
Right. But the immediate exploitation of these critical vulnerabilities, Sam, it highlights this stark contrast, doesn't it, between their rapid discovery and the fragmented, often delayed, deployment of patches across the vast, diverse Android ecosystem.
Google hasn't said who's exploiting them.
No, they declined to name the exploiters.
Yeah.
But the language used suggests surveillanceware companies are involved. The Hong Kong cert specifically noted limited targeted exploitation.
So probably not widespread attacks, but targeted ones.
Seems likely. And beyond the core Android OS, this update also addresses three critical vulnerabilities in Qualcomm's closed source components, affecting GPS, network data handling, the multi-mode call processor, plus 10 high-severity fixes for Imagination Technologies Power VR GPU.
So hardware-specific stuff, too.
And while Google Pixel owners get prompt patches and that 7-year update guarantee, they're still only a small fraction of the market, maybe 4% in the U.S.
Right. Most people use Samsung, Motorola.
Exactly. And the major Android manufacturers like them, they typically roll out these fixes, quote, when they are good and ready, which can leave millions of users vulnerable for extended periods.
Yeah.
It just reveals this fundamental challenge in protecting such a diverse, expansive user base, where the responsibility for timely security updates is spread across so many different companies.
And this is precisely where AI loops back into the defensive picture, right? Linking directly to what we discussed earlier.
Mm-hmm. The A2 system.
That A2 AI agent system, developed by those researchers from Nanjing University and University of Sydney, it's highly relevant here. This system, as you said, has already successfully found 104 true positive zero-day vulnerabilities in production Android apps. Demonstrates AI's tangible potential to significantly boost our defenses against these kinds of widespread critical flaws.
Yeah. The documented effectiveness of A2 offers this compelling glimpse into how AI can really revolutionize our approach to cybersecurity. By diligently emulating human bug hunters, using those planner, executor, validator roles powered by commercial AI models, A2 can not only rapidly identify vulnerabilities, but crucially, self-validate them with auto-generated proof-of-concept exploits.
Which saves a ton of human effort, presumably.
Exactly. It offers a more proactive and considerably more cost-effective approach to finding security weaknesses before they can be broadly exploited by bad actors. It directly addresses and helps mitigate some of that patch rollout disparity, those delays that plagued the Android ecosystem.
So AI could help level the playing field a bit.
That's the hope. The broader implication here is that as the sheer volume and complexity of software vulnerabilities just keep growing, leveraging advanced AI defense mechanisms like A2 becomes not just an advantage, but really a necessity. The fundamental question it raises is, how do we, as an industry, incentivize and implement a more unified, more rapid security response across such a diverse hardware and software landscape to effectively protect the billions of users worldwide who rely on these devices daily?
Mm. Okay, let's delve into Microsoft's incredibly diverse software portfolio now. It spans everything from core OS components, their drivers, all the way to pushing the absolute boundaries of computing itself. First up, we're seeing slow but steady progress in their initiative to use Rust for Windows drivers.
Ah, yes, the push for safer languages in the kernel.
Right. Microsoft's been a strong advocate for Rust since 2019. Azure CTO Mark Rusinovich has been actively pushing for new projects, those needing non-garbage collected languages.
Languages where you manage memory yourself, like C and C++.
Exactly. Pushing them to use Rust over CC++F, the main goal. eliminate those prevalent memory safety issues that often lead to critical vulnerabilities. System instability.
Yeah, the effort to integrate Rust into Windows drivers is definitely a significant long-term play for enhancing system stability, security, right at a foundational level. Mm. Currently, they've made progress. They've released improved tools and samples, Rust crates, Rust package units for WDM, KMDF, UMDF drivers.
Those are the driver frameworks, how they talk to the OS.
Correct. How drivers interact with the operating system. However, even with Rust, developers still frequently encounter the need for unsafe blocks. That's when they interact directly with the Windows OS's raw APIs. And using unsafe does somewhat diminish some of Rust's inherent memory safety benefits. Because in unsafe code, the developer has to manually ensure memory safety again.
So it's not a perfect solution yet.
Not entirely seamless. To address this, the Windows Driver Frameworks team is actively developing safer Rust abstractions to try and minimize reliance on those unsafe blocks. And notably, Rust code is already shipped within the Windows kernel itself in Windows 11 24H2.
Okay, so it is actually in there now.
It is. Despite this progress, though, the project is still officially not yet recommended for production use. There are persistent hurdles, particularly around official code signing and ensuring compatibility with critical tools like CodeQL for the Windows Hardware Compatibility Program.
Right, got to pass all those checks.
Exactly. The core implication is that while the safety imperative is clear and Microsoft is investing heavily, the path to widespread production-ready adoption of a new language for such foundational system components, it's proving to be a slow, methodical, technically complex undertaking.
Ironically, while Microsoft is working to make things safer in the long run, a recent Windows patch inadvertently created some immediate headaches related to administrator rights.
Oh dear, what happened?
This update, meant to fix a vulnerability, caused unexpected user account control UAC prompts, asking for admin rights to pop up for standard users.
When they shouldn't have needed them.
Exactly. It was particularly noticeable with MSI repair operations, certain Autodesk applications, or during per-user app installations.
And this isn't just an annoyance, right? It can actually break things.
Yeah, it's breaking functionality, leading to issues like Office Professional Plus 2010 failing with a specific error 1730 during configuration, things like that.
Right. This incident perfectly illustrates those complex ripple effects that even well-intentioned security updates can have, inadvertently disrupting established workflows, application compatibility in enterprise settings.
Is Microsoft fixing it?
Yeah, they've acknowledged the issue. They plan to release a future update that will give IT admins the ability to permit specific apps to perform those MSI repair operations without triggering the unnecessary UAC prompts. That granular control is absolutely necessary to maintain operational efficiency without just turning off security features.
Makes sense.
Now, on a completely different note, but equally fascinating, about Microsoft's history and innovation. The company recently open-sourced Bill Gates' 6502 BASIC from 1976.
Wow. Really? The original BASIC?
The original assembly language source code. Nearly 7,000 lines. Written by Bill Gates and Rick Weiland. Released on GitHub under the permissive MIT license.
So anyone can use it, modify it, even sell it.
Yep. Free, unrestricted use, even resale. This historical release gives this remarkable window into the very origins of personal computing and Microsoft's foundational role.
That's incredibly cool, a real piece of tech history. This BASIC interpreter, this was the one licensed to pioneering companies like Commodore, right? For the VDC-20, the Commodore 64.
That's the one. It also supported early systems like the Apple II Ohio Scientific. It played a pivotal role in establishing Microsoft's early dominance in personal computer software, long before MS-DOS or Windows even existed.
It really showcases the bedrock upon which so much modern computing was built.
Indeed. A profound testament to the enduring impact of foundational software. Now, in stark contrast to looking back at their origins, Microsoft researchers over in Cambridge recently unveiled their latest prototype for an analog optical computer. AOC.
Analog, optical, using light for computing.
Exactly. This cutting-edge machine leverages the intensities of light to solve highly complex optimization problems. Problems you find in logistics, finance, healthcare. It's designed to be remarkably fast, reportedly 100 times faster, and significantly more energy efficient for these specific types of problems compared to traditional electronic computers.
And it's built from regular parts.
Pretty much. Primarily commercially available parts, micro-LEDs, smartphone camera sensors. It's a testament to innovative engineering, creative repurposing of existing tech.
What kind of problems are they targeting?
Well, the current excitement revolves around clinical applications, like reconstructing MRI scans more efficiently, and financial challenges, like those faced by clearinghouses, Barclays Bank is already a partner there.
So specialized tasks, not general computing.
Correct. Microsoft envisions future AOC generations emerging every 2 years, potentially integrated into Azure data centers. But they emphasize it's not a general-purpose computer. It's a specialized powerhouse for particular computational tasks.
Right.
The broader implication here, looking across all these Microsoft activities, managing legacy Rust drivers, open sourcing BASIC, building light computers, it shows how even established tech giants must simultaneously manage their vast legacy, innovate at the absolute bleeding edge, and address practical user experience issues like faulty patches, often with outcomes that highlight the inherent complexities and occasional contradictions of such a broad technological remit.
Okay, let's talk about the ever-evolving world of Linux distributions now. We've got updates from both Linux Lite and Linux Mint. Gives us a good snapshot of what's happening in this dynamic open source ecosystem. First, Linux Lite 7.6. It's the latest update. Described as a technologically moderate Ubuntu 24.04.3 based distro.
So built on a stable, widely used foundation.
Right. Comes with kernel 6.8, the X4.18 desktop that's known for being lightweight. Designed with an emphasis on being simple, visually appealing, generally pretty slim.
Okay. Linux Lite 7.6 arrives with a suite of user-friendly features aimed at providing a smooth experience. Includes updated core software, LibreOffice 25.8, Chrome 140, comprehensive documentation, various helpful system tweaks, and a notable design choice, which many users appreciate for keeping things clean. The deliberate absence of both Snap and Flatpak packages.
Avoiding those universal package systems.
Yep. Despite being a contemporary 2025 release, its modest specs, 3.18 GB download, 12 GB of disk space, around 850 millimeter RAM at idle, make it relatively lightweight by modern standards.
Right.
However, it does come with a significant limitation, a key weakness compared to distros like Linux Mint or Zorin OS.
What's that?
It still lacks built-in version-to-version upgrades, meaning users have to do a full reinstallation for major updates, which can be a real deterrent for many.
Yeah, reinstalling is a pain.
Definitely. The core implication is that while Linux Lite offers a clean, efficient experience for certain users, this trade-off between simplicity and seamless upgrade paths reflects an ongoing debate within the Linux community about distribution philosophy. What's more important?
Meanwhile, Linux Mint 22.2, codenamed Zara, is another significant point release, also based on Ubuntu 24.04.3. This version brings a new iteration of the Cinnamon desktop. Wayland support is still experimental there, though, plus a host of updates to enhance the experience for all users. So, whether you prefer your Linux lean and clean, or maybe with a bit more polish and robust hardware compatibility, there are distinct options available, both of which highlight these ongoing challenges, staying current while effectively managing software distribution.
Right. Linux Mint 22.2 introduces notable improvements in hardware compatibility. It adopts Ubuntu's hardware enablement updates. This includes integrating kernel 6.2.1.4 and associated graphics drivers from newer Ubuntu releases, significantly enhances compatibility with the latest hardware.
So better support for newer machines out of the box.
Essentially, yes. It rolls what were previously separate Edge editions into the standard point releases, simplifying things for users. User experience enhancements extend to new features too. Fingerprint recognition config, an improved Hypnotix IPTV player, companion apps for Android OS, Stincy Notes for notes, Warpinator for local file sharing. The update manager now also conveniently shows a reboot button when a restart is needed after updates. A little quality of life thing.
Little patches.
But the software manager's approach to Flatpak packages highlights this broader ongoing issue within the Linux community.
Okay.
While it clearly distinguishes native.deb apps from Flatpak packages, it conspicuously does not show unverified packages. This excludes popular proprietary freeware, think Google Chrome, Slack, Zoom, where their Flatpaks are not officially distributed by the vendors themselves. They're often community package.
So Mint is being cautious about unofficial packages.
Exactly. The broader implication here revolves around this tension. Ease of access for popular proprietary software versus the desire for curated, verified package management in open source ecosystems. It's a fundamental continuous debate about trust, convenience, security, and software distribution. Oh, and a final important note for Linux users. The next Linux Mint Debian Edition, LMDE7, it will not include a version for x86 32 machines.
End of the line for 32-bit Mint Debian.
Yep. Mirroring a growing trend we've seen with projects like Firefox, effectively marks the end of 32-bit Linux support in many mainstream distributions.
Okay. Let's pivot now to enterprise software, which is increasingly under attack, posing significant far-reaching supply chain risks. We're tracking a critical code injection bug identified as CVE-2025-42957. It's an SAP S4 Jana that's SAP's core enterprise resource planning software.
The heart of many large businesses.
Absolutely. This vulnerability is rated 9.9 on the CVSS scale. That's the industry standard for severity. 9.9 is almost as bad as it gets.
Near perfect score. Ouch.
And what's particularly alarming is that this bug is already being actively exploited in the wild.
Actively exploited?
Yeah.
On S4 HANA. That's potentially catastrophic for affected companies.
It truly underscores how the impact of software vulnerabilities can go straight to the heart of organizations, from critical business systems like SAP to even, as we'll see, the personal data of school staff. Clearly illustrates that ripple effect of cyber attacks extending far beyond the initial target.
Yeah, this SAP vulnerability is indeed extremely severe, represents a direct threat to any organization running S4 HANA. The flaw allows low-privileged attackers to inject arbitrary ABAP code. ABA is SAP's proprietary programming language, which can then bypass authorization checks, enable the creation of super-user accounts with SAPL privileges, that's the highest level of access,
yeah,
directly manipulate critical business data, and ultimately lead to a full system compromise.
Full compromise from a low-privileged start. Nasty.
Very nasty. Given the verified active exploitation, SAP issued an urgent patch back in August for both private cloud and on-premises versions, stressing the absolute need for immediate application.
So patch now if you haven't already.
Absolutely critical. The broader implication here is a heightened need for vigilance in managing enterprise software. The contrast between such a sophisticated attack on a core enterprise system like SAP and the equally damaging yet often overlooked supply chain risk that impacts vulnerable sectors like education. It paints this comprehensive picture of modern cyber threats.
That's a critical point, because we've also seen a cyber attack on a software developer called IntraDev lead directly to a data breach. It affected Affinity Learning Partnership, a major UK education trust, 7 schools, over 650 staff.
The supply chain strikes again.
Exactly. This incident resulted in the potential compromise of highly sensitive personal data, names, addresses, QTS numbers, teacher qualification numbers, passport numbers, national insurance numbers.
Wow, that's really sensitive stuff.
Yeah.
Especially for educators.
It is. This incident serves as a stark, urgent reminder of the pervasive cybersecurity challenges faced by education institutions. Mm-hmm. They're frequently targeted, right? Because of the valuable personal data they hold, and often their limited IT security budgets.
Yeah, often seen as softer targets.
And more profoundly, it highlights the immense, often unexpected security risks introduced by third-party service providers within an organization's supply chain.
Mm-hmm.
Even if an organization has robust direct security measures, a vulnerability in a seemingly peripheral vendor like IntraDev can create this gaping hole.
So what was the response?
Affinity Learning Partnership responded by offering 2 years of CIFAS protective registration to affected staff. That's a service providing additional identity verification checks to help mitigate potential identity fraud.
Okay, some mitigation at least. The broader implication here is a growing need for shared responsibility in cybersecurity. It emphasizes the critical importance of rigorous vetting, continuous monitoring of all third-party vendors, especially when those vendors handle or have access to highly sensitive data. This extends beyond just the initial target, creates that ripple effect, demanding a holistic security strategy across the entire digital ecosystem.
All right, let's move on to the ongoing battle for privacy, an area where that line between security and individual rights is constantly being redrawn. We're seeing this play out in surprising, impactful places, from supermarket aisles to your most sensitive medical records.
Yeah, it's everywhere now.
For example, Sainsbury's, Britain's second largest supermarket chain. They're currently trialing live facial recognition, LFR technology, in 2 of its stores for an 8-week period.
Facial recognition while you shop. Why?
It's a direct response to a significant surge in shoplifting. They cite 20 million incidents costing $2.2 billion in 2023-24, and also an alarming increase in violence against their staff.
Okay, so combating crime and protecting staff.
That's the stated reason. This delicate balance between security and privacy, it now affects nearly every aspect of our lives.
And what stands out here is the differing approaches and the public reactions, right?
Mm-hmm.
To balancing corporate operational needs like public safety, convenience with individual privacy rights. While a July survey indicated 63% of Sainsbury's customers supported using LFR to identify repeat offenders.
Which seems quite high support, actually.
It does. But privacy campaigners, most notably Big Brother Watch, they are raising serious alarms, calling the technology deeply disproportionate and chilling. And they're citing documented cases of innocent shoppers being falsely accused, subsequently blacklisted.
Oof. False positives are a huge concern with facial recognition.
Absolutely. Period. Sainsbury's policy states that records of faces are deleted if no match is found. But the potential for error, for misuse, it remains a significant concern. And this trial by Sainsbury's isn't isolated, is it?
No, apparently other major UK retailers are doing it too. Iceland, Asda, House of Fraser, Sports Direct, Home Bargains, Co-op, either using or trialing LFR.
Wow. Becoming quite widespread then. The broader implication is that industries grappling with rising crime rates are increasingly turning to these advanced surveillance technologies. This raises a fundamental question for society. How do we define the appropriate scope for surveillance, for data sharing, and what robust mechanisms are truly effective in protecting individual rights without unduly hindering legitimate operational needs or, you know, exacerbating societal inequalities?
Right. Meanwhile, in the United States, the Department of Health and Human Services, HHS, is finally taking an active enforcement stance to compel patient data sharing. And it's backed by stiff financial penalties.
This is related to that 21st Century Cures Act, right, from way back in 2016.
That's the one. It comes after years of delay enforcing provisions of that act, which mandates patients and healthcare providers must have easy, free access to electronic medical data.
Yeah, the Cures Act was fundamentally designed to empower patients, give them easy, free electronic access to their health info, and ensure health IT developers create systems usable by providers without excessive fees or technical barriers, what they call information blocking.
But it took a long time to get teeth.
A very long time. It took four presidential administrations to finalize the penalties for noncompliance. Draft proposals appeared late 2023. Final disincentive is only formalized July 2024. Now, health IT firms face substantial fines up to $1 million per violation. Providers subject to unspecified Medicare and Medicaid disincentives. IT firms could even face certification revocation.
Okay, so serious consequences now. Has it led to many complaints?
Interestingly, despite this new active enforcement stance, only 1,336 potential information blocking claims have been filed since April 2021.
That seems a low.
It does seem relatively low. Might suggest it's an isolated problem. Although, increased awareness of these penalties will likely lead to a rise in reporting. We'll see. The broader implication is this tension between encouraging innovation in healthcare IT and ensuring patient data access. It fundamentally asks, how do we strike that balance between allowing the healthcare industry to operate efficiently and protecting an individual's right to their own health information, especially when financial incentives can sometimes run counter to patient access?
Hmm. Okay, next, let's explore how government policies are actively shaping the tech landscape, touching on everything from funding innovation to critical issues of accountability and even emerging tech nationalism. First up, FCC Chairman Brendan Carr, he's a Trump appointee, he's proposing to eliminate two Biden-era E-rate program expansions.
E-rate, that's the program for schools and libraries.
Exactly. These expansions previously funded Wi-Fi on school buses and provided mobile hotspots for libraries. Carr is now asserting these expansions were unlawful.
Unlawful?
Well, Carr, alongside Senator Ted Cruz, justified the proposals by citing concerns about, quote, unsupervised screen time for kids and significant attendant risks. Plus, they claim Congress didn't authorize off-campus broadband funding once those pandemic-era subsidies ended.
Okay. Unsupervised screen time seems like a stretch for cutting off Wi-Fi access.
That's certainly the counterargument. FCC Democrat Ana Gomez sharply criticized the proposals, described them as demonstrating cruelty and indifference. She argued they would widen the gap between those with access and those left behind, and pointed out that school Wi-Fi devices typically have built-in firewalls anyway, weakening that unsupervised screen time argument.
Right. The broader implication here is a clear philosophical divide in policymaking, isn't it? Where ideological stances can have very tangible, unequal impacts on citizens, particularly vulnerable populations and their access to essential resources like internet for education. This decision and others like it show how government policies are profoundly influencing the tech landscape, for better or worse.
Indeed. Now, over in the United Kingdom, Fujitsu is currently under intense scrutiny, facing accusations described as scandalous.
This is related to the Post Office Horizon scandal, isn't it?
Exactly. They're under fire for continuing to bid on UK government contracts, despite having publicly promised back in January 2024 to pause new public sector work following that devastating scandal.
the one that wrongfully prosecuted hundreds of innocent sub-postmasters due to severe software errors in Fujitsu's Horizon system.
That's the one, a truly awful situation.
So they promised to pause bids, but they're still bidding.
Apparently so. This situation has drawn sharp condemnation. Lord Clement Jones and 76 other parliamentarians are vocally calling for an immediate review of Fujitsu's eligibility for public contracts.
Despite their public pledge, Fujitsu was awarded a $125 million contract for Northern Ireland's land registry system, and it's currently renegotiating a significant $370 million contract with HMRC for the Trader Support Service.
How are they justifying that?
Fujitsu claims the Northern Ireland contract was already in process before their voluntary restrictions came into effect. But the lack of transparency around these new bids is alarming people. While Fujitsu has acknowledged a moral obligation to compensate the victims of the Horizon scandal, they've linked its financial contribution to the ongoing inquiry's findings.
Kicking the can down the road a bit.
Seems that way to critics. The parliamentarians argue that continuing to award them lucrative contracts significantly erodes public trust, raises serious questions about the standards of fairness, accountability, and due diligence guiding public procurement.
Yeah, it looks bad, doesn't it?
It really does. The broader implication here is this critical challenge in government procurement accountability. How can public trust be restored, maintained, when companies implicated in severe public scandals continue to secure substantial government contracts? Highlights a need for more robust mechanisms to ensure ethical behavior, accountability for major public sector vendors.
Okay. On a different note within UK policy, the Advanced Research and Invention Agency, or AARIA, that's the agency inspired by the US DARPA model, funding high-risk, high-reward research.
Right, the UK's moonshot agency.
It was notably spared from a general 5% savings request made to other UK government departments.
Oh, interesting. Protected from cuts.
Not only that, its initial $800 million five-year funding was actually increased to $1 billion and extended through to 2028-29.
Wow. So clearly a priority. Despite this political backing, though, AARIA has a notably slow spending profile, doesn't it?
Yeah, apparently it spent only $16.5 million in its first 2 years. Projections indicate nearly $600 million of its initial budget will remain unspent by the end of the current financial year.
$600 million unspent. How do they defend that?
AARIA defends this slow expenditure, argues it's an expected trajectory for an agency focused on establishing a specific culture, a process for long-term ambitious projects, rather than immediate rapid expenditure.
So focus on getting the foundations right before spending big.
That's the argument. The broader implication here is this ongoing tension. Political will to fund ambitious long-term research versus the practical realities of setting up and effectively spending within such an agency.
It raises questions about how to best cultivate groundbreaking innovation and whether traditional spending metrics are even appropriate for evaluating an entity designed for highly speculative, foundational, scientific, and technological breakthroughs.
Good point. Okay, let's wrap up this segment with a look at some significant corporate shifts and challenges. Specifically, this paradoxical interplay of layoffs and market withdrawals that are actively reshaping the tech industry. Oracle, for instance, undertaking massive global layoffs,
right,
impacting thousands of employees. Estimates range from 1,000 up to nearly 12,000 workers worldwide. Includes over 100 in Washington, 250 plus in California.
12,000, that's huge, especially when they're doing well financially, right?
Exactly. This is happening despite Oracle reporting record revenue $57.4 billion for fiscal year 2025 and an all-time high stock price.
So record revenues, record stock price, record layoffs. That's quite the paradox.
It is a stark contrast. Companies like Oracle shedding thousands of jobs, even with record revenues, potentially due to AI, while other tech giants, like Huawei, are seeing their markets literally reshaped by geopolitical forces. Paints a picture of an industry in constant, sometimes brutal, flux.
Yeah, the paradoxical nature of Oracle's layoffs, cutting jobs amidst record revenues, soaring stock prices is a significant point of concern for the tech workforce. Insiders suggest these substantial cuts are primarily targeting cloud-related positions, aimed at offsetting the massive AI-related expenditures the company is undertaking.
Ah, cutting costs in one area to fund AI investments.
Seems likely. And this isn't isolated. Salesforce is making similar moves. CEO Mark Benioff attributed 4,000 reductions in support roles directly to the capabilities of AI.
So AI is directly replacing some jobs, even in profitable companies.
That's what it looks like. This trend unequivocally raises a fundamental question about the human cost of widespread AI adoption, even for highly profitable companies. signals a major restructuring of the workforce as AI automates certain roles, certain tasks. And another round of Oracle cuts is reportedly expected in October. Indicates this is an ongoing strategic shift.
Meanwhile, Huawei's once significant presence in the UK market, it's shrinking considerably. The company is discontinuing its battery energy storage systems, BESS, products in the UK by the end of 2025.
Okay, battery storage, why are they pulling out?
They're citing it as a commercial decision, attributed to BESS products representing only a single-digit percentage of its UK revenue.
Right, but Huawei's withdrawal from the UK BESS market is also a clear, direct illustration of how national security concerns can profoundly dictate market access.
Right.
Right, and strategically reshape global tech leadership.
Yeah, the backdrop is crucial.
Absolutely. Huawei's overall UK revenues have plummeted drastically. From $1.28 billion in 2018 down to a mere $188 million in 2024. This precipitous decline is directly attributable to U.S. executive orders, subsequent U.K. bans on its 5G networking gear, all driven by national security considerations.
And that had wider impacts too, didn't it?
Oh, definitely. This geopolitical disruption not only degraded 5G network performance in the U.K., but also led to the significant loss of Android integration for Huawei devices, pushing the company to focus intensely on its proprietary Harmony OS and other global regions less affected by Western sanctions.
Right.
The broader implication here, looking at both Oracle and Huawei, these corporate decisions collectively illustrate the dual powerful pressures, technological disruption and intensifying geopolitical tension. The Oracle layoffs highlight the human cost of AI adoption, even for profitable companies. While Huawei's withdrawal is this potent example of how national security concerns can fundamentally dictate market access, reshape the competitive landscape for global tech leadership.
Okay, to wrap up our deep dive today, we have a fantastic on-call anecdote. Brings us right back to the essential human element in tech.
Always good to end with a human story.
This one features a network engineer, let's call him Warren, working at a hospital. He faced a truly critical issue. A brand new cutting-edge 3D breast scanner was experiencing massive delays, sometimes taking an agonizing 45 minutes to display scans that should appear in, like, 2 seconds.
45 minutes for a cancer scan? That's incredibly dangerous.
Absolutely. Putting cancer patients at severe risk due to postponed diagnoses, treatment delays, and for 6 frustrating months, the storage vendor vehemently blamed the hospital's network.
And the hospital.
Just as adamantly blamed the vendor's equipment. Classic debilitating blame game.
Been there. Seen that movie.
Right. This story beautifully highlights the absolute importance of clear, unambiguous communication, especially when you're navigating complex technical issues and, let's be honest, sometimes dealing with less than technical management.
Yeah. And what's truly fascinating here is how foundational network troubleshooting, combined with a keen understanding of human psychology, organizational dynamics, how that can cut through months of deadlock and directly impact critical patient care. So Warren meticulously checked all the network links, logs for the scanner, initially found no obvious errors. The breakthrough came when he proactively asked the hospital staff, report any delays immediately. Tell me the second it happens.
Smart. Get real-time data.
Exactly. The very next day, a delay occurred. He logged onto the router again, nothing obviously amiss. But then he checked the next device in the chain, a network switch. And there it was. Its logs were, quote, generating a flood of diagnostic messages and clear errors.
Found the noisy device.
Yep. He quickly discovered this particular switch was actually managed by the storage vendor, not the hospital's IT team.
Okay, so not even under the hospital's direct control.
Right, so Warren, recognizing he needed to communicate this complex technical evidence to managers who, you know, needed things broken down to the absolute basics, he created this precise, highly visual PowerPoint presentation.
PowerPoint to the rescue.
Sometimes it's the only way. He clearly laid out the network topology, showed where the scanner connected step by step, and then presented the irrefutable switch error logs. The objective, make the problem undeniable, make the solution obvious.
So did it work?
That direct, evidence-based approach worked exactly as intended. The visual evidence was undeniable, left the storage vendor's reps apparently speechless. Warren then took charge of the conversation, posed the most obvious yet somehow overlooked question. Had they tried replacing the network card on their storage array, the one connected to the faulty switch?
The simplest thing, right?
Often is. A week later, new network interface card, a NIC in place. The agonizing delays vanished completely. The old card was clearly faulty. But for 6 months, no one had thought to check this simple component, despite the severe implications for patient care.
Yeah.
The key implication here is this powerful reminder.
How often do we overlook the simplest solutions? Because of organizational inertia, a pervasive blame culture, or just a lack of precise, irrefutable data presented in an easily digestible format. Sometimes the most complex-seeming problems have straightforward technical answers, if only they can be communicated effectively, pursued systematically.
A great lesson to end on. And that brings us to the end of another whirlwind deep dive into the Register RSS feed's evening edition for Friday, September 5th, 2025. Yeah. From those perplexing, subtle biases of AI and hiring to the high-stakes chess game playing out in space, the urgent need to secure our critical digital infrastructure, and that ever-present tug of war between individual privacy and public safety. It's clear the world of tech is more dynamic, more interconnected, and more impactful than ever before.
Indeed, Sam. Today's deep dive has powerfully underscored how artificial intelligence isn't merely transforming industries. It is fundamentally redefining the very nature of employment and security. This presents humanity with both incredible opportunities for advancement and significant ethical challenges that demand our immediate thoughtful attention. We also saw how core infrastructure, whether orbiting in space, powering our grids, or guiding our air traffic, requires not just constant vigilance, but strategic, continuous investment to combat both the slow decay of legacy systems and the rapid exploitation of new vulnerabilities. And critically, the human element, whether in that nuanced struggle for privacy in public spaces or in the simple yet profound act of effective communication to troubleshoot a critical medical device, that human element remains central to navigating these complex, rapidly evolving technological tides.
Absolutely. And for you, our listener, here's a final provocative thought to mull over. Considering the breathtaking pace of advancement and the pervasive, deepening integration of AI across nearly every aspect of our lives, from how we get hired to how our critical infrastructure is secured, how do we as individuals and as a society ensure that this incredibly powerful technology remains primarily a tool for broad human flourishing, rather than inadvertently creating new divides or vulnerabilities that only a select few can effectively navigate or exploit? That's a question worth pondering long after this deep dive ends. Thank you for joining us on The Deep Dive. I'm Sam McGee.
And I'm Taylor Littis. Until next time, stay curious and keep asking the big questions.